Supporting WHYY, the Rutgers Camden MBA degree allows for specializations in critical areas such as finance, international business, marketing, entrepreneurship. Evening and Saturday classes are held at the Rutgers Camden campus and Camden County College. An information session is on Thursday, July 16th at 5:30 p.m. at the Rutgers Camden campus. Learn more at mba.rutgers.edu or 856-225-6452. The Rutgers School of Business, Camden. Expect more. Be more.
African American leaders convene in Philadelphia at a moment of heightened racial tension around the country. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The NAACP's annual national meeting gets underway this weekend in the city. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports the gathering comes at what some are calling a critical time for civil rights in the United States.
With the Confederate flag now removed from the Capitol grounds in South Carolina, the NAACP meeting in Philadelphia takes up the civil rights organization's future. President and CEO Cornell Brooks says the convention will not just be a lot of talk. He promises
to come together to formulate, to plan, to organize, to strategize, to bring about a fundamental change in the course of history in these United States. Why? Because we are the NAACP, and this is what we endeavor to do because this is what we have done over 106 years.
Chairwoman Rosalind Brock says the theme is pursuing liberty in the face of injustice.
We are here to ensure that everyone has unfettered access to the ballot box. We are here to stop the use of excessive force by police on unarmed black men and women in our community. We are here, my friends, to end racial profiling and to expand access to high-quality, affordable health care for all Americans.
President Brooks says policing will receive special attention.
One of the things that we have certainly supported is a fundamental change in policing. That means a focus on training, smoking out the biases that police officers have, building up community capital, building up community trust, so that those interactions are less charged, less stressed, less likely to lead to violence.
President Obama and former President Clinton will both address the group, but both Republican and Democratic candidates for president have been left off the speaker's list. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Check back with us next week as we report from the convention and talk to young black activists about the relevance of the NAACP in the 21st century. Today, a federal jury in Delaware handed down a verdict that prosecutors say is the first of its kind. Three members of the same family were found guilty of cyber stalking leading to a murder. Avi Wolfman Arendt reports.
In 2013, Thomas Matuszewicz shot and killed his former daughter-in-law, Christine Belford, inside a Wilmington courthouse before turning the gun on himself. Matuszewicz's son, David, had been engaged in a bitter custody battle with Belford. Prior to the shooting, federal prosecutors say David Matuszewicz, his mother, and his sister harassed Belford through emails and online videos. Assistant U.S. Attorney Jamie McCall says those actions led to Belford's eventual death.
That conduct absolutely suffocated Christine Belford. She fought back, she actively resisted them, and for that, she was killed.
The statute that enabled the conviction comes from the 1994 Federal Violence Against Women Act. All three face possible life sentences for the crime. Attorneys representing the Matuszewicz family say they will appeal. From the Delaware Desk, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Supporters of St. Laurentius Church in Fishtown won a key victory today. Philadelphia's Historical Commission voted to list the old building on the city's historic register, safeguarding it from demolition. Though, as WHYY's Bobby Allen notes, finding another use for the spired structure will be an uphill battle.
Deborah Micah was among those who spoke to the commission about the church's historical significance. She's Poland's consul for the Philly area.
The building stands as the oldest and most prominent symbol of the immigration and settlement of Polish Catholics in Philadelphia.
And the commission agreed. Former parishioner Kate Gaber says now that it's protected from demolition, an investor might step forward.
I feel like it's like the birth of my child. right? It's just so wonderful. And we will get the money. We will find ways to get the money.
But the closed church has been listed for sale. And real estate broker Brendan Flynn says five developers were intrigued.
And the general consensus was that if a historical designation was approved, that these groups would not have an interest.
A lot of design requirements come with a historical designation. Many developers say it's just not worth it. Plus, attorney with the parish Mike Phillips says full restoration would cost more than $4 million. The indebted parish spends tens of thousands of dollars a year just to maintain it. Phillips likens St. Laurentius to another Catholic site on the historic register, the Church of the Assumption on Spring Garden Street. The crowd didn't like the comparison.
It is a blighted, abandoned property with missing windows, holes in the roof, and vacant. And okay.
Meanwhile, supporters face three main obstacles: finding enough money for restoration, finding a developer to take it on, and perhaps the tallest order of all, persuading the parish to give up the property, since its officials are dead set on demolishing and selling the land. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
On October 29th, 2012, the largest Atlantic hurricane ever recorded made landfall, and by the time the giant storm moved offshore, Superstorm Sandy was second only to Katrina as the costliest hurricane in U.S. history. New Jersey and New York sustained about the same amount of damage, though to date the Garden State has received much less federal aid than New York. NJ Spotlight Sandy recovery writer Scott Gurian analyzed the disparity and joins me now with details. Scott, thanks for being here on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me back.
How much damage and what's the disparity in aid?
So the rough equivalents I've heard are that New Jersey has said that its damage from Sandy was somewhere in the magnitude of $37 billion of unmet needs. New York, the original figure was $18 billion, but then I spoke to state officials. They said that was just a preliminary estimate. That was just for upstate, didn't include the city. Once you add everything together, they figure that New York and New Jersey had roughly the same amount of damage. Now, in the past, I've looked at one place where New Jersey got much less to aid, which is with money from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. New Jersey got about $4.2 billion. New York City and New York State each got separate allocations, together totaling about twice what New Jersey got. And we looked at a variety of reasons for that. In this case, what I was focusing on was another metric, FEMA public assistance aid, which goes to repair damaged infrastructure after a major storm. And in that case, to date, New Jersey has gotten just $1.7 billion in FEMA public assistance, while New York State plus city combined have gotten $7.7 billion, $6 billion more.
In taking a closer look, to what extent does it depend on the type of damage sustained in each state?
That's a large part of it. You know, I looked at a number of partial explanations for why that was the case, why there was such a disparity. And the biggest one that I found was that while the two states may have experienced similar levels of overall damage, New Jersey's damage mostly affected individual homeowners, while New York City's damage was more to its infrastructure, which, you know, cost a lot more to repair. There was this dense urban environment with things like flooded tunnels and subway lines, which were way more expensive than, say, replacing damaged boardwalks and piers. So to a certain degree, it makes sense that New Jersey would get much less money to fix things like that. Now, that said, some critics I spoke to speculated that the state still probably could have gotten more than it did if it had handled the recovery differently, putting more qualified folks in charge of the process and being more proactive fighting for money from FEMA. New York hired a firm called Adjusters International, which deployed hundreds of field reps to help local towns make sure FEMA was capturing all of their damages when they were applying for aid. New Jersey hired its own firm called Witt O'Brien's, and some people told me they were happy with how things turned out. But Witt only had a few dozen people on the ground, so some critics felt that they simply didn't have the manpower to do as effective of a job as they could have done.
Is there an unspoken implication then that perhaps had Adjusters International also been brought to the Garden State, it might have done a better job on behalf of New Jersey?
Some people believe that. And in fact, some private municipalities have hired Adjusters International after Witt O'Brien's already did their inspections, and Adjusters has been able to get more money from FEMA than Witt O'Brien's had originally.
And so how do New Jersey state authorities respond to these inquiries?
Well, a spokeswoman at the New Jersey Office of Emergency Management told me that New York and New Jersey are two different states with different needs, so it's not fair to compare them. She also said she's confident that the people New Jersey hired did all they could to get the state the funding it deserves. On the question of why it got so little money for infrastructure, the Department of Community Affairs sent me a statement explaining that helping the tens of thousands of displaced homeowners was more of a priority, since shelter is a basic human need, and they said that the state did the best it could with the limited funding it had.
To what extent, though, are we speaking in the past or present tense? What more can be done for those in need in New Jersey at this juncture?
From what I've heard from insiders, they say that, you know, it looks like the state of New Jersey has pretty much wrapped things up and is moving on. They kind of want to get done with the Sandy recovery and move on. You know, one of the criticisms I've heard is that New Jersey is kind of rushing to kind of wrap this up, whereas maybe even 2.5 years in, almost 3 years, you know, after the storm now, they should still be continuing to fight to get more money.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
That's NJ Spotlight Sandy recovery writer Scott Gurian on Newsworks Tonight. Turning to this evening's headlines, Amtrak says it will not contest liability for compensatory damages stemming from May's deadly derailment in Philadelphia. 8 people were killed, more than 200 injured when the train going more than double the posted speed limit crashed at Frankfort Junction. By law, Amtrak's legal liability is capped at $200 million per incident. There are more than a dozen lawsuits pending in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and New York. Amtrak also wants to consolidate the cases before one judge. Meanwhile, New Jersey Transit is among many regional railroads in the nation that will not be meeting the end-of-the-year deadline to install the so-called positive train control system to prevent derailments. An NJ Transit spokesperson says the agency is having difficulty acquiring licenses for the system and needs to work out operational issues with its freight line partners. New Jersey officials say positive train control will be in place by 2018. Both Amtrak and SEPTA say they'll meet the December deadline. 84 degrees, clear skies on Independence Mall. It's 6:18. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. This evening's forecast, clear skies, low 68 degrees overnight. Sunny days right through the weekend, high tomorrow and Sunday around 90. Partly sunny Monday, high 86. There is a chance of late day showers. Tuesday, cloudy with a 40% chance of precipitation, high in the mid-80s.
Still ahead. If a fence separates Center City from the neighborhoods where poverty is ever present, will the Pope see the wall between rich and poor?
Reflections on this fall's papal visit from Newsworks blogger Solomon Jones on Newsworks Tonight after this break.
The Cooper Heart Institute supports WHYY. Their multidisciplinary team of cardiologists introduces the new Watchman device, a minimally invasive treatment option designed to reduce the need for long-term blood thinners in patients with non-valvular atrial fibrillation, thereby reducing the risk of AFib-related stroke. The Cooper Heart Institute is a comprehensive heart care center with offices throughout South Jersey. Details at cooperhealth.org/watchman.
On the next reveal, a doctor who has to act like a detective just to treat his patients.
They were careful encounters, always sworn to secrecy.
Tracking down the trade secrets behind sick workers at the most innovative high-tech companies in the world. That's on the next reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Get more interesting Sunday afternoon at 2 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. 54 years after being raised as a protest of the civil rights movement, the Confederate flag no longer flies over the state capitol in South Carolina. Let's tap into American sentiment on this issue with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, has Gallup done new polling since 9 black churchgoers were murdered at Charleston's Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church June 17th?
We have. We were in the field just a few days ago, actually updating a question about the Confederate flag that we had first asked in 1992, and then we had asked it again when this was a controversy back in 2000. Interestingly, Nationally, very little change since 2000. 47% of Americans say it is all right for southern states to display the Confederate flag, and 46% say it is not. That's basically where we were back in 2000. But, and this is the important point, what's happened is we've had an increasing political polarization. Republicans have actually become more likely since 2000 to say, yes, it is okay to display the Confederate flag. Democrats have become less likely to say that. So we've had this split, this gap, so to speak, between the two parties, and that keeps the national average, however, about where it is. So the bottom line is Americans split, even today, on whether or not the Confederate flag should be displayed.
Though let's note that in South Carolina, it is Republican Governor Nikki Haley who was very much in the vanguard of the effort to have that flag removed.
That's right. And of course, we don't have just South Carolina Republicans in our sample. We can't break it out that finely. But when you look at Republicans nationwide, 2/3 say it is all right for southern states to display the flag. I should point out that there are big, naturally enough, racial differences. 73% of African Americans that we interviewed said that the southern states should not display the flag. And that compares to 41% of whites nationally.
Some might be surprised, myself included, that it's only 73% of African Americans who feel the flag shouldn't fly.
We ask another question which sheds a little light on this. Do you view the Confederate flag as a symbol of Southern pride or as a symbol of racism? And we had asked that question previously. We just updated it. Overall, we still have a 20-point gap in terms of Americans saying it is a symbol of Southern pride rather than racism, 54% to 34%. And in answer to your question about African Americans' views, 19% of blacks nationwide will say it is a symbol of Southern pride for states to fly it, but we have 69% of blacks nationwide who say it is a symbol of racism.
Does Gallup also do a breakout by age or region?
We do by region. There are not a lot of differences by age, except the ones we would predict because of the underlying political differences. Region, the South really doesn't stand out that much. 41% of residents in the South say that southern states should not display the flag. And again, that compares to 46% nationally, so it's a little below the national average, but it is by no means this huge, Confederate versus Union kind of gulf that we might have anticipated. 49% of those in the East say that the southern states should stop, 50% in the West, and in the Midwest, it's about 47%. So the South's a little less likely to say it shouldn't be displayed, but it's not a huge gulf.
Frank, we're now some 2 weeks out from the U.S. Supreme Court decision reaffirming the legality of the Affordable Care Act. And I know Gallup has been polling on this matter since the act was enacted. Have those attitudes changed?
We're seeing a little movement. That's absolutely right. We had a time last fall in the midterm election, the environment of the midterm elections in 2014, where the Republicans did well, where we had a 12-point gap, unfavorable versus favorable, disapprove versus approve on the Affordable Care Act. We had updated it in April, and that gap had shrunk to 6 points, and we just updated it again, as you say, after the SCOTUS Supreme Court decision, and now we're down to just a 1-point gap. 47% of Americans say they approve, all in all, of the Affordable Care Act, and 48% say they're disapproved.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. The Pope is set to visit Philadelphia this fall, and the big news over the past week has been around an expected 8-foot-tall security fence around some portion of Center City. Newsworks blogger Solomon Jones hopes that that fence doesn't obscure some of the city's more impoverished neighborhoods from view.
Pope Francis is scheduled to visit Philadelphia in September, and it's my hope that while he's here, he will tear down walls rather than build them up. But when I learned that the U.S. Secret Service was considering erecting a fence around parts of Center City as security for the Pope's visit, my hopes for tearing down walls were diminished. I'm fully aware of the need to secure the Pope during his visit. After all, we live in a world in which bombers eagerly take their own lives in order to kill others. We live in a world in which hate drives men to walk into churches and kill worshipers as they pray. We live in a world in which dangers both real and imagined drive us further and further behind walls. But I wonder if the Pope will even see the walls, if he's hidden behind a wall of his own. If a fence separates Center City from the neighborhoods where poverty is ever present, will the Pope see the wall between rich and poor? If that fence stands tall enough to block out the middle-class neighborhoods that house many people of color, will the Pope see the wall between stereotypes and reality? If the only time he ventures beyond that fence is to visit a Philadelphia prison, will he have the opportunity to emulate Christ and set the captives free? I'm glad that one of the stops on the Pope's itinerary is the Karen Fromhold Correctional Facility, a prison that currently houses over 2,700 inmates. In total, our prisons, which are really county jails, hold about 8,000 people on any given day. Three-quarters of them are awaiting trial. Many are there because they can't afford to pay bail, and the vast majority do not perform at a high school level. In other words, those who occupy Philadelphia's jails were behind walls long before they were incarcerated. I'd like Pope Francis to visit the places that feed those prisons. He should visit the 22nd and 25th police districts, where nearly 3,000 violent crimes were reported in 2014. And after he visits those places, he should look at the poverty rates for those areas and ask if the lack of education and the prevalence of poverty helped fill the prison he will see. And when he's finished visiting the violent neighborhoods that helped to make us the poorest city in America, he should visit the 24 schools we closed in 2013. And when he walks the abandoned halls of Germantown or Bach or Carroll, he should do so with the realization that on average, the students who attended those schools were over 90% impoverished, over 90% black or Latino, and 100% abandoned by our city. I hope the Pope will help us to tear down the walls that stand between us, but in order to do so, he'll need to look well beyond that fence. I'm Solomon Jones.
Solomon Jones writes the Philadelphia Experiment blog at newsworks.org. You can hear him weekday mornings at 7 on 900 AM WURD. Finally this evening, if you're looking for an all-cat acrobatic show this weekend, you're in luck. The Acro Cats are coming to the Painted Bride Arts Center in Philadelphia for six shows through Sunday. Now, the Traveling Cat Show started some 10 years ago by trainer Samantha Martin, who rescued the cats, all former orphans or strays. She told Philadelphia Magazine that, contrary to popular opinion, it's not hard to train cats. The show also features the Rock Cats with Cluck Norris, a chicken, sitting in on cymbals. But while the show seems to be all fun and games, Martin says it's also intended to draw attention to animal overpopulation and homelessness. Part of the proceeds for the show in Philly will go to the Philadelphia Community Cats Council. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. We had help this week from our intern, Maggie Freeling. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the helm this week, Al Banks and Adam Staniszewski. Joyce Lieberman is our radio engineering supervisor. Chris Cetullo is WHYY's Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
The Barnes Foundation supports WHYY and invites everyone to dive into art this summer at the Barnes with unrivaled masterpieces from Renoir, Matisse, Picasso, Monet, Cezanne, and Van Gogh, plus African sculpture, metalwork, and more. Featuring tours, workshops, live music on First Fridays, and programs for the whole family. Plus a contemporary exhibition, Mark Dion, Judy Pfaff, and Fred Wilson, The Order of Things, on view for a limited time. Tickets at the door or at barnesfoundation.org.